Welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, I'm really glad that you have joined us. Before we get started with the show today, I just want to take a moment to recognize the historical significance of today. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson is going to begin her confirmation hearings in Washington in a little bit. She would be the first African-American woman confirmed to the nation's highest court. And what she talks about with the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee will not only be interesting and, I think, incisive, but also, again, really historic. You will be able to listen in to those hearings if you want to here on WDET. You're going to have to go to the website, though, and we're going to offer a stream embed there. We're not broadcasting those confirmation hearings live here, but again, you will be able to go to the website and listen to the stream if you would like to. All right, our neighborhoods really shape us, and they leave marks on our lives. They provide a particular perspective and a way of interacting with the world and appreciating specific symbols, narratives, and events. They nurture us, and they surround us with teachers and caregivers and lovers, and sometimes they are even kind of punishing and restrictive, offering fewer opportunities for care. Of course, more often than not, they are a combination of all of these things. And we go through life trying to sort out, I think, the many different influences that come to us from the places that we're from. But regardless of the neighborhood you grew up in, success is often determined in America by how far you've moved away from it. That's especially true of poorer communities. So many of us grow up in places that we, as adults, want to say, hey, I got beyond where that was. I was able to escape, some people say. But is there an alternative to that narrative? Can we both remain in and reclaim our communities and be successful? And if so, how? This is a question that I've struggled with the neighborhood that I'm from here in the city of Detroit near Grand River and Livernois. I was gone from that neighborhood for 3 decades before I started really thinking about, hey, is there a way to still be part of this community, to still be lifting people in that community up? Even though I've moved really far away and in various points of my life, left the city even. So to talk about that tension between leaving home and building connections with home, we have Majora Carter, who's author of Reclaiming Your Community. You don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. Majora Carter, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, as I said, the neighborhoods we grow up in shape us in really important ways, but poorer neighborhoods are often described as just one thing, something bad that we want to get away from. So I want to start here. You are from the South Bronx, which is a neighborhood that has that kind of reputation in a lot of people's minds. But I want to give you a chance to talk about what it was like to grow up there.
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for the introduction to the book. I don't even need to do anything now. So I'm from the South Bronx, and it was historically, you know, Latino, Black community, often known by, you know, what it isn't. You know, we are the poorest congressional district in the country, or one of them anyway. And, you know, there were just sort of like a plethora of problems to be solved. And, you know, it's what we've noticed is that billions of philanthropic and government dollars have gone here, yet we've remained economically stagnant. I grew up during the era of the burning Bronx, literally when landlords were torching buildings to collect insurance money. And, you know, and that was during the 70s and the 80s. And we've still not really evolved from that stigma. But what I'm trying to be is that it's about reclaiming your community, because reclaiming here means we don't measure success by how far we get away from them.
Mm. And as I said, that's a tension that a lot of us kind of struggle with. And I'm not sure that we come up with great answers about how to maintain those connections. So what does that look like in practical terms? A lot of people would say we should live in those neighborhoods, right? That we shouldn't leave them physically. But I think you're talking about something even more complex than that.
Absolutely. What I'm talking about is that, you know, we borrowed the approach from the business world. It was essentially like a town, and as a community developed, never lost the Cinderella stories that emerged from those places. But there's very little done to retain the talent. And what turned out, that those Cinderella stories, sometimes called brain drains, were taught to measure success by what we're, by what we measure our success by, which you can't find in that community. But it turns out people want the same thing that everyone else wants, a lifestyle that makes them feel like cafes, where you meet other people and express themselves. Mm. So reclaiming is about recognizing that there's value in the marginalized can and should aspire to create a future that's economically and emotionally and spiritually meaningful to ourselves, and that's for ourselves as well.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking with Majora Carter, author of Reclaiming Your Community. You don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. We're talking about how we stay connected to the places that we're from. How do we maintain those important ties to people and to place? And importantly, how do we lift up the places that we're from? So many of us here in Detroit are from places that really struggle, that were really struggling when we were coming up, but continue to struggle today. And I think there is a constant question maybe in our minds about what our obligation is to those places and what our opportunity is. What are the ways that we can stay tied to those places? What are the ways that we can open up opportunities for other people to get away from those communities if they want, or to build better lives for themselves in those communities, which is the thing that I think all of us want. We want to hear from you during this conversation as well. Are you working to improve your community? Did you happen to grow up in the community where you live now? Do you feel a particular tie to that home community and to the idea of trying to improve it? And what kinds of projects do you work on in your community to make it better? How do you decide that that home is an important place to lift up as well as where you may live now? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page and put comments there, or you can go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation that way. I know that this is a huge part of life here in Detroit, and so I'm really looking forward to hearing from people about their home communities, the places that you're from, the corner that you're from, which is so often how we describe where we're from here in Metro Detroit, and especially in the city of Detroit. Tell me about what that community was like. What was it like growing up there, and how you stay connected to it if you do? Again, 313-577-1019 is the number. Majora, you moved away from the South Bronx for a time, and so many people do that. What do you say to people who are trying to succeed by moving away? And tell us what it's like to go back after you have been away.
Sure. I mean, it's
you know, no one can blame anyone for wanting to seek greener pastures and to, you know, find success in some place where they don't feel like they're being fed. I mean, look, I was taught from a very early age, as were many of my peers, and I think in a lot of communities like the ones I'm literally talking to through this book, is that you measure success by how far away, you know, you're talented in some way, shape, or form, and, you know, you should grow up and be somebody. And so when I actually did come back home, you know, to go to graduate school, I went to NYU, and since I was a broke college student, the cheapest place to stay was my parents' house, and it absolutely felt like a defeat. But then it was, but I'm so grateful that because I had some education and some distance, and I realized that there were real policies and, you know, regulations that systemic racism that literally created the things in my community that made me and people like me want to vacate as soon as we could. And that's when I realized, why are we continuing to do this? We're treating poverty as if it's a cultural attribute, almost as if it's part of our DNA. And also, there are plenty of institutions that are doing quite well and benefiting off of the poverty, concentrating poverty. You know, it's a good game. Or, you know, developers, you know, who know how to work the federal subsidies, the pharmaceutical industries who do really well because of the lifestyle-related health conditions that are in our community. You know, there's all of these things combined kind of create this atmosphere that, again, makes people feel as though they need to measure success by how far we get away. Mm-hmm. And so I understand that that's how people feel, but I also feel like it's what we've done to our communities by continuing to sort of keep that example and perpetuate it is actually reducing and not helping us at all, you know, as communities, as people. And I think it's almost even like one of the unintended consequences of integration in particular for Black communities, wherein, you know, people, because of legislation, we were able to move out of our communities. And so we were, prior to that, we were economically diverse, racially segregated, but economically diverse. And those, you know, many of the folks that were actually making money owned property. When they left, that really helped to degrade kind of the social and economic fabric of those communities, leaving us vulnerable for the very particular predatory speculation that we see happening in our communities right now, which absolutely has a lot to do with the lack of generational wealth in our communities too. Because if we don't see value in our own communities and we have property there, we'll sell it early and cheap. And yes, I'm not saying that, you know, years and years of historically discriminatory practices in banking don't have something to do with that. But in many of the instances that I know, like, people are selling because they're receiving cash offers that seem like a good idea at the time because they don't see the value in their communities.
Right. They don't see a future for staying where they are. Absolutely. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones, and you can go to social media as well. Big Neo on Twitter says, I lived on Carlin near Schaefer and West Chicago, and it acted as a safe space for me in the 1970s and 80s. I would hear about bad things, but it wasn't on my street. I credit a big portion of that to the Black fathers that were on my block as they looked out for us. That's such an important memory. Yeah. And that idea of I can remember this also from being a kid here in Detroit. You would live in a neighborhood that other people would describe as bad or poor or whatever, but your experience there often didn't take in all of those bad things. I mean, you lived in your house with your parents and your siblings, and life in many cases was kind of shielded from some of those other influences.
Yeah, when I was growing up, I mean, and even as the neighborhood was literally burning around us, I mean, there was still, you know, parents, the sense of love and community in the neighborhood was real, right? You know, there were street games that we would play, Skelzy, literally in the middle of the street, you know, jump rope, et cetera. And parents definitely looked out for each other. However, it didn't displace the fact that we still saw it on the nightly news. You know, we were considered the poster child for urban blight. Mm-hmm. And it was an absolute dream for families, you know, to try to get their kids out of those communities eventually. I mean, they made the best of it while they could. And it's, but it's sort of what I'm really trying to remind people with this book is that, yes, even despite, you know, how horrible things may seem outwardly, there's also always like a sense of community in those areas. But it's often overshadowed, you know, by this whole idea that these communities inherently have no value while we're in them. And that's what we, that's what we've got to get through.
Big Neo, I really appreciate the comment and the memory on Twitter. Let's start on the phones here with Darren in Detroit. Darren, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Stephen. I appreciate today's topic.
Sure.
I'm a Detroit native, graduated from Cass Tech, and then went on to an HBCU, Prairie View A&M University. One of the things that I gathered in undergrad was this whole idea of self-determination, this idea of you build your community. So for me, it was very important, especially graduating from that HBCU, to come back to the city of Detroit to build the city means with my own children, with other people's children, participate in coaching teams, participate in where we worship. That's just another sense of community. Our economics, it takes place in our community. This is where people grow up together. They get to know each other, and then they begin to do business. They begin to worship. They begin to create not only businesses, but create institutions within our community that uphold our community. So it's very critical that we come back to our community, not only for people to see our community, to see what goes on in our community. It's the pride, sort of like Black Bottom and other Black business districts, if you will, around the country, way back in the 20s. That's something that, that should have never been disbanded. For whatever reason, whether it was an expressway or an attack on a community, where we, our root, our core exists in our community. So if that's disbanded, if we move outwardly, then we don't have that so-called core anymore.
Darren, I really love the things you're saying here in this call. And I love that, that your experience really has taught you that it's important to be here, to just to be here is I think one of the things that that we don't think has enough value. Majora, you know, one of the things that I was reminded of when Darren was talking is this idea of brain drain that we that we suffer in communities here in Detroit, that the people who would be best suited because of their experiences to lift up a community where they're from often have to feel like they go somewhere else. And, and here it's often other cities, not just other neighborhoods. They leave. And that's one of the things that perpetuates those conditions.
Darren, that was an incredible example of exactly what a talent retention community development approach looks like. Like, you are literally going back to where you're from, using your talents and support of the folks within your own community, your your friends, your family, and passing it on. And that the idea that you would take your talents and go someplace else is so common. I mean, again, it's a bit of a Cinderella story that I think Americans in particular love, you know, where you go to, you know, from a hardscrabble place and then you, you know, get an education or something and then you take it someplace else and you suddenly you're like a big dog. And it's just like, why do we do that? I mean, if we looked at our communities as companies, you know, we would never do that. Companies don't hire people, you know, to, and, you know, pour resources into them and benefits so that they go work for somebody else. But we do that, you know, in particular in our communities, like it's nobody's business. And it's just understood that it's normal. And again, I think that's sort of like we're coming out of the legacy, you know, of white supremacy that essentially does tell us that our communities don't really matter, especially while we're in them. And so we behave accordingly, like so much so that we will leave them when given an opportunity. And again, that's an, I think, an unintended consequence of integration. You know, we're stuck together because we're racially segregated, but if we have the means to move, we do. And unfortunately, but that, but like what Darren was talking about was just so beautifully said, because it's all about like, how do I like literally pass this down all the talents that I've got right now and use them. And I feel like I don't think that talent retention as a community development strategy is going to solve either gentrification or even the idea that, you know, that concentrated poverty in our communities is okay. But what I do believe is that without it, we will not be able to progress very much, because the underlying problem is the lack of wealth creation and talent retention in those same communities.
Yeah. Again, Darren, really appreciate the call and you're sharing your story. Let's go next to Brad in Shelby. Brad, what's on your mind?
Oh, I don't know. I moved out of my community in West Virginia when I was 17. I joined the Air Force. There's no jobs there. Gotta go to where the jobs are.
Yeah, Brad, that's a really common story, and it's a common story from the part of the world that you come from, which is this idea that there is an opportunity there, and you have to go to someplace else to get that opportunity. And Majora, that is, for a lot of us, what carries us away from home. And it sounds to me like Brad hasn't found the way back. In other words, that opportunity leads you somewhere else. How do we counter that? What's the lever we pull, I guess, to incentivize more people to stay in the places where they're from because of work?
Yeah, no, I've been inspired by folks, examples that I've seen around the country, and I, in West Virginia, one of my dear old friends who passed away, unfortunately, Judy Bond, was seventh generation coal mining family. You know, was hoping to do wind power, community wind power before she passed. Not exactly sure where stuff like that is happening there right now, but what I was struck by is how, you know, trying to figure out like what can we do to create powerful and access within our own communities to economic and environmental and social well-being. And, you know, one example that I used in my book was actually from Alaska, probably even more rural than where you're from in West Virginia. You know, in the Native American nation up there, the Eyak nation in particular, you know, is really working to, you know, their culture, their economy based on fishing. Now they're actually realizing that kelp farming is something which has some tremendous commercial capabilities in manufacturing. It's used in everything from like beauty products down to cow feed, you know, to reduce methane. Mm-hmm. And so they're actively working to figure out ways so that there could be a native owned kelp farming initiative, you know, going on up there that would actually employ lots and lots of people up there, because their unemployment rate is also incredibly high. But again, they're actively looking and working to find out, you know, what are the economic growth trends, and how can we, you know, use what we have in our own communities and build businesses that are actually going to support us as a nation, as an economy, and locally. Yeah. And so I think that's also some of the things that we have to consider doing. And it's building those local businesses that, you know, allow dollars to circulate within the community, and also, you know, creating much larger ones that could also create better and reasonable, you know, opportunities for people to actually build real, you know, lives and careers and generational wealth from them.
Yeah. I think we would be remiss in not talking at least a little about the racial dimension of all of this, and the black-white wealth gap, and the experience that you had. You and your siblings ended up selling your parents' home because you needed the money, and then, of course, at some point, the home became quite profitable for somebody else. That's another thing that we see in cities like Detroit all over the place. The investment that African Americans made in property didn't pay off the way it was supposed to. They sell, and then somebody else is able to come in, usually somebody of another race, and get wealthy off of it. Talk about that experience.
Sure. And it wasn't so much that, I mean, look, they were happy to get, you know, some money out of the property. My siblings was. My father bought our house in the 1940s for $15,000 in cash that he one at a horse track in California. He was a Pullman porter, literally carried that money back in a satchel to New York, plunked it down in front of the Italian family that owned the house that he eventually bought. And because he couldn't get a loan, he was a big old black man. Yeah. You know, this was the 1940s. It wasn't going to happen. So when both my parents passed, you know, in the late 2000s, none of my siblings saw the value in keeping our home. Hmm. Because to them, it was just like, they thought it was cute that I was doing this community stuff, but they were just like, no, we're moving to Jersey. We're moving down south, whatever. We're out of here because there's really no value here. So the fact that anybody's offering us anything, that's better than probably what it's worth. Yeah. And yeah. So really what that meant is more, and yes, that house is actually worth at least three times more than what it was sold for. But again, what it speaks to not is more so the fact that the reason why predatory speculation works so well in this country is because we are often convinced that there's no value in our community while we're in it. Yeah. And so in that regard, it's very easy for predatory speculators to literally like make our assets show up on their balance sheets. And then support their families as opposed to it being, you know, our opportunity to create generational wealth for our own.
Yeah.
And because once we lose that asset, generally most of us don't get it back. Yeah. And that's a real problem.
Yeah.
That we have to acknowledge and really start thinking about it, because the definitely, obviously, systemic racism, you know, historical issues around access to capital and, you know, historical discrimination in banking is real. It is very real. But one of the things that I've absolutely noticed is how quickly, you know, many folks in our communities will sell because we don't know the value of our own homes, even if we own them outright. And then that is something that we need to address as a community, so that we're sharing this kind of information with each other, so that we don't like make the mistake of literally having our children's legacy, you know, handed over to somebody else's family.
Wow. Okay, Majora Carter, author of Reclaiming Your Community. You don't have to move out of your neighborhood to live in a better one. It was really great to have you here with us. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next, we're going to talk with Jazz Fest president and artistic director Chris Collins about what that event will look like this year. It's been virtual the last 2 years. Are we finally going to return to that wonderful in-person experience of the Jazz Fest in the middle of downtown Detroit? Find out next on Detroit Today.